present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Get a little more intelligence on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
In the war for sanity, the war is definitely not over, but there have been some victories you might not have heard of. In business schools, there's an entire field of study known as change management. This is because when executives or consultants come into a company that is floundering, changes need to be made. However, changing attitudes of the people that are there to get better outcomes is not always easy. There's a built-in bias against change. That's the way we've always done it. Well, that always done it way isn't working. To turn a company around, you need to get the people that are still there on board and pulling in the same and better direction. And one of the elements of that is to help create some victories. That helps people see that the recommended changes are having an impact. They're starting to win again. People need to believe they can win and that, most importantly, the new direction will get them there. That's why victories, where you can get them, especially in politics, help start changing directions. And that can shift not just one ideology. Victories can start changing the direction of the whole country. Kimberly Herman is the president of the Southeastern Legal Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to defending liberty, guaranteed by, not given by, guaranteed by the Constitution, and they will sue the government when it violates those constitutional rights that it's supposed to defend. And unfortunately, that does happen all too often. Kim, it's great to talk to you again. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's great to be back with you.
Yeah, so we want to talk about Title IX because with all of the furor of the whole birthright citizenship case, I really think this got overshadowed and that a lot of people may have missed this. So just to kind of encapsulate this, the Supreme Court issued a landmark Title IX ruling on June 30th, 2026, in West Virginia versus BPJ, which was consolidated with Little versus Hecox, holding that Title IX permits states to ban transgender athletes from participating on girls and women's sports teams based on biological sex. In a 6-3 decision, the court determined that Title IX allows schools to maintain separate sports teams for men and women defined by biological sex, and that laws in West Virginia and Idaho restricting team participation accordingly do not violate federal civil rights law statutes. So walk us through this ruling.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. It was kind of overshadowed a little bit, but this is monumental. So what you actually had here was we had two states, Idaho and West Virginia, that passed laws that said biological boys cannot play in girls' sports. In Idaho, we had a biological male who was in college who wanted to play on a women's sports team. And in West Virginia, we had a middle school student at the time who wanted to play on the girls' sports teams. And so they sued to challenge these laws, saying they violated Title IX and the Equal Protection Clause. Excuse me. And what we had happen here was the court came in and said, no, these laws absolutely do not violate Title IX and the Equal Protection Clause. Sex in both of those means biological sex, and states can ban boys and girls sports if they want to. With the Title IX piece of this, we actually had a 9-0 ruling. That's also getting missed. And yes. So a really strong statement from the court on Title IX.
Yeah. In some ways, I was really surprised to see that it was unanimous because you've got one justice there who wasn't even sure what a woman is. She couldn't define it in her hearing. So as far as this case is concerned, there's some analysts are saying it's not maybe quite as thorough and one-sided as it possibly is. Somebody had said that Justice Kavanaugh's majority opinion says that states may keep sports sex separated, not that they must keep it. And some analysts are saying, well, this is kind of a narrow ruling that leaves bathrooms, locker rooms, and other spaces completely untouched. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so when you actually like really dissect the opinion, I think it says a lot more than what's in the language. So yes, the actual ruling says that states can ban boys and girls sports because that's what was before the court, right? And excuse me, we've talked about this many times before, I know together, about how, you know, courts can't go outside the case to make extra rulings and such. But when the court came down and said that sex means biological sex, that is going to open up the window for all of us to be bringing lawsuits against the other 23 states here that allow boys to play in girls' sports, and against school districts in all 50 states that are allowing boys and girls locker rooms and bathrooms. Because if they base their policies on so-called gender identity instead of sex, that's right there a violation of Title IX. And arguably a violation of the Equal Protection Clause also. And so they basically gave us the roadmap to bring those additional lawsuits. So the fight is far from over, but the law is set that we know when we bring those cases, we are going to be winning them.
Well, and that's so encouraging, the fact that this is one of many battles in this larger war. And to get this kind of ruling, I think really says a lot. I have to share this because you had posted this on X, and it was your daughter's schoolwork, where the assignment was to write about a new law that she would make. And her argument is no boys and girls sports. And among her arguments is it would be unfair and dangerous because men are stronger. I mean, did you ever imagine yourself growing up a time when that laws would be needed to codify the most obvious and basic biological facts that, yes, men are stronger, men are different than women, or that we would have to get to the point for the Supreme Court to step in and say, yes, men, in fact, are stronger than women, and they ought to be separated in sports, and that's fine?
No, I never imagined that as a parent. I would be having to have conversations with my children. My daughter's 9, my son is 12, saying to them that, to my daughter, if you show up to a softball game and there is a boy on the other team, we are forfeiting. We are not playing, because that puts you at risk and at danger.
Absolutely.
If you ever go in a bathroom and there is a boy or a man in there, because there are grown men.
Yes.
Right. We represented a mom in Pennsylvania who the coach from the other team was insisting on using the girls' locker room and changing in front of young high school girls.
Jeepers.
And he was allowed to do that, and his contract was renewed. Never in a million years did I think that these were the conversations I would have with my 9-year-old daughter. But I will tell you, that is why we fight. We have to educate our kids on these issues too, and not be afraid to talk to them about it.
Well, there's just something, I'm going to be frank here. It's just something weird about an adult male feeling that he needs to be seen naked by women, or that he would feel compelled to be in there with women. Even aside from the fact that it's a gender difference, men versus women and whatnot, there's something I think just wrong with a guy that feels that he has to do that. You would just think.
I mean,
just
absolutely.
Plus the fact, I mean, that's an adult in front of a child. That's the worst part of it.
Yeah, I mean, in addition to just the sick nature of it,
yes,
right? When
absolutely.
You're looking at it from that perspective, the fact that you have states, we have 23 states that are insisting that our girls be faced with that on a daily basis. And we have school districts in all 50 states. I mean, we're suing schools. We've got cases in Kansas, Georgia, Florida, in the heartland of America, down here in the South, where people don't expect this to happen, where we're having to fight through the court system to keep boys out of their bathrooms and locker rooms. It is appalling. As a lawyer, it's unconstitutional. And as a mom, I will fight to the end for this.
Yeah, absolutely. It needs to happen. There are some battles out there quietly being won. We'll talk more about those up next with Kimberly Herman from Southeastern Legal Foundation. That. We're talking about winning some battles today. We're doing that with Kim Herman. She is the president of Southeastern Legal Foundation, a national nonprofit constitutional litigation firm founded back in 1976. If you have cases, they would love to hear from you. So, Kim, I want to go back just a little bit because we had some conflicting numbers there, and I want to straighten out for our audience. So I had said 6-3. You had said 9-0. So straighten those two numbers out for us.
Yeah. So a lot of people are saying that this is a 6-3 ruling. And when it comes to like the reasoning on it, it is. But there were actually two cases here that were consolidated together. And in one of them, there was an argument that the state law violated Title IX. In the other, it was that the state law violated the Equal Protection Clause. This matters because one is a statute passed by Congress and one is our Constitution. But ultimately, what we had here was we had all of the justices agreeing that Title IX did not ban states from saying that boys can't play in girls' sports. They just didn't all agree on the reasoning and on the equal protection piece. And so very nuanced legal aspects here that all of us attorneys who do this every day can argue in court. But what it means for parents is that you can have the confidence that Title IX protects your kids. And so just last week, we filed another Title IX complaint. This one was on behalf of a mom with a special needs daughter who was told that she had to use a restroom with a boy who identifies sometimes as a girl and sometimes as a furry, but that she had to use the restroom with him, and that was that, right? So we, you know, we're filing all these new Title IX complaints. That's just one, because we now have this assurance that Title IX really, really protects our girls, just like we knew it did.
Hmm. Well, looking back at like some of the arguments there, Justice Thomas had written within that a man does not have a legal right to compete against women just because he believes that he is a woman. I think that's pretty blunt, but it's still kind of surprising that both rulings were not 9-0. So what was the reasoning by the three liberal justices, all three of whom are females? Why do they still seem to be confused over what a woman is and why she deserves to be separated from men?
Oh my gosh, that's a loaded question. I mean, at the end of the day, you have different approaches to the Constitution, typically, when you're getting these kind of varied opinions. But here, it's even more than that. It's really very ideological. And, you know, you mentioned that we have a justice who couldn't define what a woman is during her confirmation hearings. We also had lawyers in this case who couldn't define what a woman was, right? Justice Alito very, very pointedly asked that question to, you know, the plaintiff's attorneys here, and they couldn't answer that. And so, you know, it's really just trying to reach an end and of how you want these cases to come out and ideological differences, right? There's really no doubt that in 1972, when Title IX was passed, that sex meant biological sex. And there's certainly no question that when the 14th Amendment became part of our Constitution in the 1800s, that sex meant biological sex. To say otherwise is just so disingenuous. So that's really what we're dealing with here.
Well, we had talked earlier about the psychology of some of this, and I think this is kind of along those same lines. Why is it that so many people on the left, there's a psychosis there that it's almost like they're afraid, you know, and again, just getting back to that hearing, the confirmation hearing, it's like they're afraid to admit that men and women are different. I don't understand why you can't accept that that's what basic biology is. Have you ever thought about what is driving that mentality? Why do they insist that you can just merge the two as if there are no differences?
Oh, many, many times, right? I mean, there's books and tons of scholarship out there on this. But at the end of the day, what it really comes down to is that there are people out there, as Justice Thomas pointed out in his concurring opinion, and he wrote this, right, that, you know, when you're looking at these issues of gender dysphoria, that this is a mental illness. And it's people not wanting to recognize that. But there's also something just so unbelievably wrong about all of this. Like we were talking before, it's not just locker rooms and bathrooms, right? You see these drag queen story hours at libraries, yes. And you see these drag shows with kids brought, you know, this isn't your RuPaul of the 1990s on MTV or something like that, just coming out in a dress. These people are naked, right? I mean, when you actually look at this, of what's happening at these shows, and they're in front of children, and apparently it's okay because it's a man who thinks that he's a woman instead of just a man. Like, how is that okay? There's just a sickness that's happening here, and it has infiltrated into our schools. It has infiltrated into our teachers' union beyond. We have to be diligent as parents. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Sorry. I can just go on and on about it. Right. And you and I, we've talked about it all the time separately off air too. It's got to be stopped.
Oh, absolutely. It does. And just because somebody has a mental illness, it doesn't give them the permission to do something. It might explain why they want to do something. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so they've got a mental illness that wants to expose themselves to children and be seen by children. Okay, but that doesn't mean you should be able to do it. There's a lot of mental illnesses. It's kind of like saying, okay, that guy's an alcoholic, so go ahead and let him drink. That's not how you help them. And yet we've got a situation now too. We had talked to a psychiatrist a couple of years ago. She was running for state office here, and she said the mandates now by some of the psychology associations is that you need to affirm mental illness rather than try to correct it. And that's, I think, especially dangerous. I mean, if somebody came in and says, well, I'm Superman, are you going to really encourage them to jump out the window from a 10-story building?
Yeah, point very well taken there, right? And we also have, parents who are losing their kids over this, right? You've got states like California. It may be the same out in Oregon where you are. I'm not sure.
There was a case like that, yeah.
Yeah, in Colorado and stuff, where if parents are not allowing their young children to mutilate their bodies and take drugs that will sterilize them, the state is coming in and taking them from them. I mean, this is happening.
Yep, it's pretty scary. Okay, let's go take a break. We'll wrap up with Kim Herman after this. Southeastern Legal Foundation fights to defend your constitutional rights when government decides to run right over them. Their website is slfliberty.com, slfliberty.com, and we're talking with Kimberly Herman, their president. And so, Kim, we've been talking about Title IX, and looking back at this, because you were in the executive office, I think back in January of 2025, when Trump signed that executive order, effectively getting rid of Biden's Title IX changes. And then fast forward to just recently here with this massive ruling. But along the way, how is it that Title IX, which was designed to ensure women had equal opportunities for things like sports and schools, how did it go from giving women equal access to men having access to women's locker rooms?
Yeah, so it actually started during the Obama administration. What a lot of people don't realize is during that administration, we had these three memos that the Department of Education put out, and they honestly, it was just a memo. It didn't go through the proper rulemaking process or through Congress. And one of them said that if boys want to use the girls' bathrooms and locker rooms, the schools have to let them. Another one changed the legal standard that you would apply to determine if Title IX was violated from an objective standard to a subjective. So in other words, if someone felt like their feelings were hurt or that they were offended, they could bring a Title IX case against you. And then the third was that they actually did change the definition of sex back then to mean gender identity. It was missed by so many people because nobody even knew what gender identity meant back in 2004. Like, nobody was talking about it.
Yeah.
So they were very sneaky in doing that. Now, Trump 45 undid all of that, but that's when it really started to take hold.
Defend that ideology, I guess. You had mentioned too how this is impacting parents, and of course that's the big thing. And you had mentioned California, and I'm reasonably certain that Oregon had a similar case. That to me is the real danger, is when you're allowing the states to have these kind of parental impacts. But even beyond that, getting back to the idea of these are our kids, it used to be growing up is that back in the 80s and 90s, and you were really working to protect the innocence of children, to separate them from these kinds of things. And if somebody had pulled up in a van next to a high school or elementary school, God forbid, with some pornography or anything else like that, he'd been arrested. And now we have naked people in schools, for heaven's sakes, that are adults. And so as far as some of these other cases, like parents losing their kids out in California and whatnot, is this ruling going to specifically affect those?
Yes, it'll have a trickle down effect, essentially, because you're no longer going to be able to lean on these definitions. So much comes out of what is the definition of sex, to be honest, and so many of these laws. What's going to really help those parents, though, is going to be something that we saw out of the Department of Education and the Department of Justice a few weeks ago, where they entered into this agreement, like an interagency agreement, which again sounds really fancy. But what it does is it gives the Department of Justice more of an enforcement ability to investigate situations like that. So when schools are hiding these gender transition plans from parents, when schools are coming in and really being the ones that are instigating these kids to make these changes and hiding it from parents, we're now seeing increased enforcement from DOJ. And I think it's just going to continue. They just swore in like 100 new attorneys yesterday. And a lot of them are going to be working on these civil rights issues. These schools better stop what they're doing, because their federal funding is going to get pulled.
I certainly hope so. Yeah.
And I'm here for it.
Yeah.
I'm here to watch it. And we're here to expose it too. I mean, one of the things we're doing at SLF is trying to expose those secret gender transition plans. We're trying to expose these schools that are violating Title IX, so that the DOJ can come in. They issued an enforcement letter against a school in Kansas that we're fighting against, where our client's daughter has suffered severe emotional trauma from this what we're talking about today.
Sure, sure.
Well, we're going to see a lot more.
Speaking of parents and cases, Oregon, of course, is pretty insane in this kind of stuff. If somebody listening has a case that they think that you guys might be interested in, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you guys?
On our website, slfliberty.org, there's a case inquiry button up in the top right, and just submit that case inquiry and it goes straight to our legal team. And if it's something that we can help you with, then we will get back to you.
Okay. So we only got a couple minutes here with you, and we probably should have reserved an entire segment for this, but we can't let you go without getting your take on the whole birthright citizenship ruling. What is your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, my main reaction is that everyone thought it was going to be an 09, you know, or 9-0 opinion, I guess, against the administration. And it was not. It was 5-4. There's some legs to stand on there. And I think that what we need to be paying attention to are things like these insane billboards and the insanity now that it's becoming this, you know, birthing tourism, if you will. The administration's not going to back down from fighting against this, and they shouldn't. I hope they don't. We're going to see more cases, more action from them. We know Congress won't step in like it should, but this is certainly not the end of this fight.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of the best things I saw on this was a meme where the cartoon character is saying, so you're saying America was founded on stolen land, but now you're saying that the child of a mother that was here for less than 24 hours, it belongs to them.
I hadn't seen that one. That's a good one.
Yeah. So Kim, unfortunately, we are up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time today. This has been great.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This week on iFi Radio, it is about winning some battles. The war is not over, but we are at least winning some battles. In the first half of the show, we talked about Title IX, and now we're going to shift gears to winning battles against climate change. I'd like to bring back Craig Rucker. He is a co-founder of and the president of CFACT. That's Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow. Craig, it's great to talk to you again.
Hey, Mark, thanks for having me on the program, as always.
Yeah, so winning some battles, it seems kind of amazing that we're talking about this. I mean, the last time we talked to you, we're starting to see some daylight at the end of the tunnel there. But one of the surprising ones was Dr. Judith Curry. She is one of the most respected skeptic voices in climate science. She just shut down her blog, Climate Etc., after 16 years, and her sign-off line was, "It's time to declare victory against climate stupidity and move on." And so CFACT itself put out a tribute to her. What do you think? Is she right that the war is basically won, or is that just a bit premature?
Well, where she is in life, she's gone through quite a bit. You're talking about a woman that used to be on the side of the alarmist, if you went back 20 years ago, and then had a kind of, you know, coming to Jesus moment, I guess you could say, and looked at the data and found that much of what people were advocating just, it didn't basically add up. And she was really offended initially when she made that conversion that she couldn't even raise questions without getting attacked, as she was a professor at Georgia Tech. And we chronicled her in one of both of our, I think, of our movies, Climate Hustle and Climate Hustle 2. And, you know, wound up becoming a great warrior for going out and could speak with great authority because she was a really accredited climate scientist and made some real changes. You know, I mean, I think she started kind of an avalanche. You got a bunch of other people from Schellenberger to Bjorn Lomborg and others that came out after her that kind of followed in that wake and had courage to turn the corner kind of. And I think it really made a big difference in the scientific community. So prominent was she that I know Trump appointed her as part of a climate working group last year. And she worked with the Department of Energy to produce for the first time something with a government stamp of approval on it, something that challenged the UN climate science. Well, you know, that wound up being, unfortunately, put under the table because of a filing error. But nevertheless, she's been a great champion, great warrior. And, you know, it gets fatiguing getting attacked all the time. And she's leaving at a high note. Yeah. Right now, she's correct. This is one in which at this precise moment, we're winning. But as we know, if you've been in the game long enough, things are never quite as bad as they seem, but sometimes they're not quite as good as they seem.
Yeah.
And I think she is leaving at the right time. I always said that about NFL quarterbacks. I kind of wonder if Brett Favre had left when, you know, maybe a couple years before he did, if it might not have been better. So, yeah. You know, in some ways, I think she's taken a strategic exit, and this is a good time to do it.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's over quite yet, and I think Real Clear Science pushed back a bit on that, saying that it's too early to declare victory because the activist infrastructure in schools and the media hasn't gone anywhere. However, they are certainly more quiet. Curry had cited some measurable numbers there that media climate coverage was down 32% in 2025 and then took a huge drop, 42% in the first quarter of 2026. And among some of the more prominent propagandists, the Washington Post cut its climate desk from a much larger team down to five. NPR folded its 10-person climate desk over into General News. Those are some pretty big shifts when the biggest promoters of climate change are suddenly saying, we're not going to cover this so much.
Well, yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, coupled with Bill Gates, of course, stepping back from saying what he did about, you know, well, the end of the earth isn't going to come. He still thinks it's an important issue, but, you know, maybe we're not all going to die from it tomorrow is kind of an assessment of what he said. And you got also just, you know, they weren't able to agree on a phase out of fossil fuels last year at the climate conference. You got a number of countries now reconsidering their position as to what they're going to do on net zero. And Europe in general is taking a second look as to whether or not they need to reassess what they're doing. So I think on balance, it isn't a bad time for her to leave. But I also know that how quickly the winds of fortune can change, you know, because if you look at where we were just 4 years ago, climate was the number one priority of that administration, the Biden administration, and they caused all sorts of damage. And I'm still not sure that we're not, you know, especially in many of the blue states, still, you know, reaping the, you know, they're wreaking havoc on their energy infrastructure. Yes. And I think it's going to take a while. It took a while to get into it. It'll take a while to get out. But, I'm, you know, God bless her. She was a real trooper, and we're going to miss her.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back to that blue states because there was a study on that that I think is really interesting. As far as why they're pulling back, as far as the media is concerned and why they're pulling back, do you think it's the media is following the audience that there just isn't as much interest in climate change, or is the media maybe following federal grants and marketing dollars have dried up?
Yeah, I think people, and it really kind of started with COVID. I think that they were on the march for ascendancy up until that particular episode where trust the science became suspect with the public. And I think it helps having a commander in chief where Trump routinely calls climate change a hoax, and they'll say, well, it's not really a hoax or science. Look, people understand what he means. What he's talking about is what Greta Thunberg and what Al Gore and what the UN is saying is a hoax. And he's been validated for a long time. We have this, why am I forgetting the number, RCP 8.5 or something like that.
Right,
the
yeah.
Most extreme climate scenario was just admitted it was a fraud. And even you got people that are writing it for the Greens saying, yeah, we threw that out there, this kind of scary assessment, but they made policy on it, thinking that, you know, things would be far worse than they really were. So they were kind of blowing smoke on a lot of what they did. So I think Trump was validated in that, and he continues to call it that. And I think that that actually plays with the public to a degree, because you need somebody with courage to come out and call it what it is. And I think it's had a public impact.
I agree. And I think pulling the money has certainly made a huge difference as well. You had mentioned how damaging it was what Biden had done. And within the Inflation Reduction Act alone, according to Al Gore, who was giving a speech over in Paris, I think, he said within that one bill, it was going to be $639 billion for the green energy movement. Imagine the uproar if just $1 billion had gone to the NRA. The left would be still screaming about it.
You're right. Now, here's a reason for some caution on this. When I say things are never as bad, but they're never quite as good as they seem either, the environmental movement is still well-funded. You could probably do an AI search, and I think I did one recently for a talk I was giving in Germany just a week ago. It astounded me how much the top 10 green organizations get. It's something around over $4 billion with a B, dollars.
Yes.
And if you took the top 10 conservative groups that work on climate especially, and that would include the Heritage Foundation, it's under $200 million. You get rid of the Heritage Foundation, it's under $100 million.
Wow.
If you take the top five groups, which would include, you know, Competitive Enterprise Institute, Heartland, CFACT, these CO2 Coalition, you're talking under $25 million for those groups, you know, combined.
Yeah. And as long as they're sitting on a $1 billion, $4 billion war chest, I think I could probably make that last for a few years, waiting for the next Democrat administration to kick in. All right, and we'll stay with us. We'll continue with Craig Rucker after this, looking at winning some battles on the climate change front. Back. We're talking about winning some battles here. Started the show talking about Title IX victories, and now we're talking about some victories here in the climate change front. We're doing that with Craig Rucker. He's the co-founder and president of CFACT, Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow. You can visit them at CFACT.org. And so, speaking of CFACT.org, you know, every once in a while you come across some headlines that you think, okay, so is that either a typo or is it too good to be true? And I came across one that says New York wisely guts landmark climate change, climate law. And I might have thought it was clickbait, but it was on CFACT.org. And so I thought it's got to be real. So talk to us about what happened here.
Well, Governor Hochul had kind of a waking up moment there. I think it kind of had a wake up and smell the Kool-Aid. I don't know what the right term is, but or coffee, I guess. But nevertheless... All right,
it
give
might be cool,
your listeners a little bit of a background on this. Back in 2019, the legislature in New York passed a law that said that they wanted to have the state get a 40% reduction in greenhouse gases by the year 2030. Now, part of that also required the rules to get there would have to be released in 2024. Well, these are fairly painful things that would have to happen in the state of New York in order to reach that goal. So, you know, 2024 came and went, and they didn't make any rules because I guess they didn't want to get run out of town with elections coming up. So a bunch of green groups sued the state of New York and said they had to make rules because this was law. And Hochul said, no, it's not law, they're just goals. Well, a judge disagreed with him, said, no, that's a law. You guys have to actually come forward with it. Well, with rising electricity rates in the state, she kind of challenged her, you know, went after that, saying that, well, it's, you know, we'll appeal that decision just to try and do things. But the judge gave him until 2026 this year to try and come up with some sort of hard-hitting rules that would have to be placed on New Yorkers. They never did do it. The legislature passed in late May a law that says basically we're going to move the deadline to 2040, and it's just a recommendation. It's not a rule. So basically they gutted their whole law that required a reduction, made it more or less where they have flexibility and they could be more or less a goal. And, you know, New York had to do this because what they've actually achieved, they only got 10% reduction, according to one of our analysts. And that was achieved basically by shutting down their coal plants and replacing them with gas-powered plants, which is kind of the way that a lot of states have actually reduced their emissions, but also achieved it by having a lot of heavy industries leave New York. So now that they've got pretty much all the industries they want to out of the state, and they've pretty much done what they can with that, the remaining, you know, ability to get down there would have to be with something far more painful. So they just booted the decision down the road. And, you know, you don't get many victories in blue state, but we'll take this one as going the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's really astonishing to think that one of the reductions was a reduction of the industry, and that ended up fitting their goal of reducing carbon emissions. I mean, that's really horrible when you think that that's one way that you can actually meet these targets. And I know that wasn't their intention, but for heaven's sakes, I mean, that's just astonishing. You know, New York is hardly a booming economy right now as far as attracting all of these businesses because of these types of mandates. And it's the same thing on all these blue states where you've got these mandates.
Well, and you see that. I mean, you have what's the Rhode Island governor there, Dan McGee. He's actually, they got a 100% renewable mandate by 2033. So he's backtracking on that, trying to, you know, get rid of it just like Hochul did.
Yeah.
And he's removed subsidies for, you know, solar. They said that that'll save the state $1 billion. So he's attacking it. Yeah, Massachusetts, they're cutting their surcharges on utility bills for efficiency upgrades. You have California, the CARB, you know, the Clean Air Board there. Adjusted its cap and invest to ease the their emissions cap. So it seems to be a trend in blue states not to abandon entirely the whole net zero philosophy, but scale it back.
Well, I'm encouraged to hear all of these things that we're looking towards moving at least somewhat in the direction of common sense. I have not yet heard whether Oregon is going to abandon its own climate protection plan. And this is something that industry insiders have said that by 2028, when phase two kicks in, conveniently after the next election, natural gas prices will increase 300% from additional fees. So I'm glad to hear other states are doing this. I just am not holding my breath for Oregon, but we'll see. Certainly, if they get a new governor in there, that could certainly change things. There was a study that we had kind of touched on earlier that had also found that the increase of prices here within blue states, and the summary here says that 86% of states with above average electricity prices voted Democrat in both 2020 and 2024. And one estimate puts the gap at roughly 38% higher average residential rates in blue states, with blue state rates up 32% since 2014 versus 18.5% in red states. So is that pretty much entirely due to these renewable mandates?
It is. As a matter of fact, our good friends at the Institute for Energy Research have done some a number of really fantastic studies on this thing. And now what they're stating is, and some people say, elect Democrats and that'll happen. It has nothing to do with that. It's that what the Democrats have as energy policies that they've imposed in these blue states.
Yes.
These would be things like cap and trade. Up in the Northeast, they call it the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. You have one in California, too, that's kind of a cap and trade. They call it cap and invest. What they do is typical cap and trade.
It's because cap and enslave doesn't play so well.
Exactly. So they say cap and invest. They'll take some of the monies that they get through the auctions of these carbon credits and put them into clean energy measures or to help with the for poor people to be able to afford energy efficiency upgrades, all those types of things.
Yeah.
Anyway, they're contributing to just skyrocketing electricity costs here.
Right.
And as they continue to shut down their coal and their fossil fuel plants, electricity rates rise as they become more. And a lot of these states also have what they call renewable energy mandates, saying that they have to get a certain percentage of their electricity, 30, 60%, 80%. As I mentioned, Rhode Island, 100% by 2033. Well, that's not going to sustain their economy. And you'll see in every one of these states that have these mandates, the only way that they actually survive is they have to go to red states and ask for electricity to be shipped to them.
Yeah.
And that's always the case. That California is a net energy importer. You know, it does not export electricity. And but for the fact that you have Arizona, Texas, Nevada, and these other states pumping electricity to them, they would not survive.
Yeah.
So that's the case universally. It's not just in the United States. It's globally.
Yeah. And of course, that impacts the larger economy, too, especially when you look at some of these trade deals that Trump has, where trillions of dollars are coming into the United States. Well, when those companies have to decide where to site, where are they going to do it? In an expensive utility site like Oregon and some of these other ones, or are you going to go to a red state where it's a lot less expensive? All right, everyone, stay with us. We will wrap up some victories here with Craig Rucker from CPAC. Stay with us. And welcome back in our final segment. Now we're talking today to Craig Rucker. He's the president and co-founder of CPAC. That's Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow. You can find out more about them and see some of their great articles. We mentioned one earlier, CFAC.org, CFAC.org. And so, Craig, we've been talking about these mandates and whatnot, and they do. There's a recent study that showed that these are, in fact, driving up electricity costs, which we all knew was happening. And of course, these blue states are the epicenter of those. So here's a question. I know you're not an attorney, and I know that CFAC is not a law firm, but do you know if there already are or could be or will be lawsuits to sue states for unnecessarily high prices because of those mandates?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. If they do, they probably will be suing the wrong people. The ones that are, you know, the ones that are actually the full energy providers. So I don't think that you're going to see any lawsuits against the utilities per se, but probably some of the users. And of course, I put paramount in those, the people like the data centers and those types of things that are using it, and as opposed to who are the real culprits are the state, you know, and the ones who are planning for the electricity use for a state. It's not so much the data centers themselves. A lot of them produce their own energy, and a lot of the places with the most data centers actually have among the lowest electricity rates, and in fact they're even rising slower because they're going in a lot of red states that have ample electricity to provide for them. So the bottom line is, I think it's not, you know, I think it's going to go against the wrong people, kind of like what we're seeing in Boulder, Colorado, where you have people wanting to sue the energy producers like Exxon because of the fact of bad weather going on around the world. And it's a way for Boulder, Colorado to cash in on the climate sins that they claim the big oil companies have created in the world.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely crazy. So that another victory here, I think, in terms of the battles against climate change, Duke Energy just agreed to walk away from its Carolina Long Bay offshore wind lease, and they are taking a $129 million federal buyout and redirecting that money into nuclear and natural gas generation instead. And I found this rather odd. The company's own filing said offshore wind, quote, is not currently the most reliable, cost-effective energy source. And that just seems a little odd. I mean, this is a company that had just been trying to put in windmills. So are they admitting defeat on this? I mean, do you expect to see more of these kinds of buyouts?
My hope is yes. And in fact, that seems to be the experience of the wind farm off of Massachusetts, where they found exactly that, that since it's been, it's one of the only ones that actually got up and running. And that's because it predated Trump and his ability to stop it. But that particular one found it's producing about half the electricity rate that they said it would. And it's much more expensive. So, of course, we've been warning about that for a long time. There have been lawsuits trying to stop the Vineyard Wind facility. But, you know, I think they were wise in taking that buyout and moving on. And I think an awful lot, there's a lot of companies that have just abandoned it. You have Ørsted, you have, you know, BP, I believe it's BP, and other ones that have just walked away from this sort of thing. So my hope is that this will not actually see the light of day moving forward, and that the utilities kind of learn their lesson and aren't going to go this route.
I would hope so. I think a lot of this, my own guess on all of this, is that a lot of it really comes down to the federal money's drying up for these kinds of things. And, you know, as far as climate change is concerned, it was always a religion. It was never a science. You weren't testing it. You weren't dumping billions of tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere to see if whether it really is directly related. So, I mean, it's always funny what you can afford to believe when it's somebody else's money. So now that the hysteria is largely dissipated, though, and hope we continue to see more of these victories, what ought people and governments be doing around climate variations, for example, like more forest management, building dams and reservoirs? I mean, California at one point had enough dams and reservoirs to withstand 6 years, I think, of severe drought. So do you think we'll start seeing practical applications in order to actually mitigate changes in the climate?
Well, yeah. I mean, to be honest with you, I think that most of the climate that we are seeing is not particularly extreme. No. That really requires much mitigation because it's just natural weather variation. I mean, people are making a big deal. Yes, it's a hot summer right now. We have Chris March. He's actually a meteorologist that works on our staff. And he looked in and said, yeah, the DC was saying climate change, 3 days of hot weather right around the 4th of July. And wow, there's a proof. Well, back in 1901, there were 7 days consecutively of over 100 degree temperature, which is before climate change could have been the culprit. So I still think that, you know, measures done to take into the account the climate, it's mostly a regional warming for the most part, and it's mostly urban. So it's because of the concrete and asphalt. And my speculation is that if you look at the temperature records and everything, it's not just my speculation. Yeah. It's actually been admitted to. But it's the idea that the urban areas are the ones that are warming up, I think, just getting air conditioning and things to be able to cope with the artificial warming that you see in cities. And that's why when you have the mayor of Paris now saying that she is not going to allow for more air conditioning, only about 25-27% of Europe has it. Yeah. You're seeing heat deaths go up.
I suspect what she's really saying is I expect everybody else to turn their air conditioning off. Mine will be on full blast. Unfortunately, we're up against the clock here with Craig. I want to thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you, Mark. Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. That is all of our time for today. We hope you're a little wiser for having been here. You know, if it's been a while since you've been to our website, go check out the latest show page. We'd love to see what you think of the new layout. Today's show is ispyradio.com/16-28. That's /16-28. There are still lots of fights ahead, of course, but take heart with the victories that you heard today. I hope that they're going to inspire you to continue fighting and to make a difference. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.